On Tech News Today, Google buys a music service. The FTC tells T-Mobile to stop cramming. Microsoft is bringing Office to Android tablets. And the government tells Amazon to crack down on downloads by children. And you won't believe Amazon's response. All that and more coming up right now.
This is Twit.
Bandwidth for Tech News Today is provided by CacheFly at CacheFly.com.
This is Tech News Today for Wednesday, July 2nd, 2014. This episode is brought to you by Personal Capital. With Personal Capital, you'll finally have all your financial life in one place and get a clear view of everything you own. Best of all, it's free. To sign up, go to personalcapital.com/TNT. And by ZipRecruiter. ZipRecruiter makes hiring faster, easier, and cheaper. Post your job to 50-plus job boards with one click. Try ZipRecruiter for a free 4-day trial now at ZipRecruiter.com/TNT. That's ZipRecruiter.com/TNT. Tech News Today is the show where we talk about the tech news with the journalists who report it. Welcome to Tech News Today. I'm Mike Elgin. Jason is off today. Anthony Nielsen is filling in for Jason. And our guest co-anchor is Jason Heiner. So we still have a Jason. Jason Heiner is global editor-in-chief of Tech Republic and global long-form editor of ZDNet for CBS Interactive. Welcome, Jason.
A pleasure. Always good to see you, Mike.
Good to see you, too. Always glad to have you on the show. Now, today is a very special day in the history of consumer electronics and also of music. And we're going to be talking about music and consumer electronics on the show. But first, it's the 35th anniversary of the Sony Walkman. John brought this in. He actually sprinted home to get this, but isn't this a beauty? 35 years old. This came out July 1st, 1979, for the price of $150. And inside of this thing is a strange object of interest here. I don't know what this is, but it seems to have some sort of tape or something inside. Anyway, this is the original Sony Walkman, and a lot of people draw a direct line between this, Jason Heiner, and the iPod, and then the iPod to the iPhone and so on, and then the music services we had today. Did you own one of these at some point?
Oh, yeah. More than one. Multiple.
Really?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it was great. It was one of those things that it was one of the first devices where it was that kind of like pocket or at least clip on your belt kind of device that, you know, where you took your electronics with you. And, you know, it was iconic, obviously, you know, you carry that around. It was also sort of predated this idea of technology as fashion, right? As a bit of a fashion statement, meaning you carried that around. People noticed, like, you know, you were kind of technical, you were kind of techie if you were one of the first ones carrying one of these things. And it really sort of whet our appetite for this idea of carrying our technology with us and not sort of having to sit down and experience the technology, you know, sitting down, but take it with you wherever you're going on a run, you know, on a hike, on a vacation. And that was the precursor to, you know, all the mobile technology that sort of dominates and that everybody's become so infatuated with today.
Yeah. And clearly this product inspired Steve Jobs and made it clear that you could have a music player that was very personal, very portable, beautifully designed. By today's standards, this is not beautiful, but by the standards of 1979, this was elegant and super well designed. And of course, that inspired Steve Jobs. It inspired iTunes and the iPod and so much more at Apple. In fact, a lot of people don't realize that Steve Jobs' uniform of the turtleneck sweater was based on the uniforms that Sony employees use. He idolized and really lionized Sony as a company for their design sensibility. And he actually proposed that Apple employees wear uniforms. Everybody around him shot that idea down completely. but he went ahead and wore a uniform himself, again, based on Sony. So it's a really an interesting day in the history of technology, 35 years ago today, $150. And wow, what an anniversary. And it just doesn't seem that long ago, does it?
Yeah, man. So, I mean, think about everything that's happened since that device came out, right? I mean, light speed since then.
Right. And that was years before the web came out and, you know, all that kind of stuff. So what a world it was since this came out. And, of course, it's been all downhill for Sony since then, and they're still struggling. They're still making money on insurance, though. That's the good news. Well, let's jump into the news. Google bought Songza yesterday, the company that makes a music app that competes with Pandora, RDO, Spotify, Beats Music, iTunes Radio, and other music services. Bobby Osinski is an author and Forbes contributor who writes about music and the music business. Welcome, Bobby.
Thank you for having me, Mike.
Glad you're here. Hey. Now Google has the money to buy just about any music service. They've got piles of cash. They could have bought a lot of not only a music service but a lot of users to go with it. Why did they buy Songza, do you think?
Well, Songza has the one thing that's most important to them, and that's music curation. Music curation is kind of like the holy grail right now, and it's yet to be seen whether it's really effective in attracting users or not. But the general industry thought is that it is something that's really important. And it would take any company, even one with the resources of Google, a long time to actually come up with the stable of curators that Songza has right now. They have about 50 or so. So this was kind of like a no-brainer for them. It was also relatively cheap at $39 million is what they're reporting. So it was kind of like a no-brainer, I think.
Yeah, and you know, curation is also something that Beats Music specializes in, and Apple paid a heck of a lot more for Beats Electronics than Google is paying for Songs. Of course, that came with some mediocre headphones and two industry big shots as well. But human curation doesn't sound like a very Googly thing to do. Google's better known for creating algorithms so that you don't need people to do things like curation. Isn't that kind of a curious thing that Google would purchase a company that's all about human curation?
Yeah, it is. But the fact of the matter is that so far, human curation has beaten algorithms every time. Algorithms are just not as good as blood and flesh human being at creating a playlist. So that's one of the reasons why they went for this, I think. Well, I think that was the main reason, because certainly it had nothing to do with music licenses. They have them already, so it's not that. It's not users, because they only had 5.5 million. And besides, Google can get plenty of users. They own YouTube, and YouTube is the number one destination right now for music discovery and just music use in general.
And can you tell us a little bit more about Songza? They do some kind of special services around matching playlists to the user's context. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, well, that's one of the things that a human can do fairly easily, I think, and that's they could comply with someone's mood, location, an event, anything like that that might seem like a place that you can apply a song list to, and humans are particularly good at that, better than an algorithm, and you'd think it'd be just the opposite, actually. You'd think an algorithm would be able to figure out the perfect playlist for weather. But that's not proven to be the case so far. And I think a lot of it has to do as well with not only those type of things, but just the fact that if you get a, I don't want to say a celebrity, but it's almost like the old days of FM radio, and FM radio just started, where you had someone, the DJ at the time, who was a trusted source of songs. And you knew if you listened to the particular program that there was going to be more things that you would like than not. So you began to listen for the DJ. And to some degree, playlists are like that as well. You begin to look at a playlist or playlists of a curator because you like their taste. And really, you can't say that about an algorithm. Oh, I like that algorithm's taste. But you can for a curator. So, again, that's one of the attractions, I think, that Google has and really the industry has for curation right now.
Yeah, and, of course, they have an odd deal with the Weather Channel that will change the music based on what your local weather is. So if it's rainy outside, they'll play sad music. And if it's the sun is shining, they'll play happy music, I guess. I mean, I guess that's how you match music to weather. Kind of a curious thing. The other thing about Songsa that is Google oriented is that they are advertiser supported. And of course, Google itself is advertiser supported. Probably better than 95% of their revenue comes from advertising. At least that was the case recently. And Songsa launched in the fall of 2011. They're U.S. only, or they could be in Canada as well, I guess. But I do know that they're not in Europe, Asia, or Latin America. And we don't know the price. It was somewhere between $15 million and $39 million, probably closer to $39 million because apparently there were multiple buyers. The value would normally gravitate down to about $15 million, but there are multiple buyers, and so that probably cranked up the price quite a bit. Now, you mentioned that they have 5.5 million regular users. Compare that with Pandora, which is about 75 million regular users. Pandora is the leader in users there. Now, what do you suppose, Bobby, that they're going to do with this service? Are they going to keep running it as an independent service, or will they fold it into Google Play Music? What are they going to do with it?
Well, I think the word right now is they're going to keep it going as normal. And certainly that's until they can figure out how to integrate it best. But of course, there's a really big service that Google is very close to launching, and that's the new YouTube music service. And what YouTube is trying to do is leverage their advantage so far that they have on music consumption. And right now, the best way to do that is start a new service around it. It's kind of curious because in a way, what they're doing is cannibalizing their all-access service as well with this, you would think anyway. But I've talked to people who've seen this, and it's been very closely held so far, so you don't get too much information. But I've talked to people who have seen it, and they said it actually is pretty great. One of the things that was kind of holding them up was the fact that they didn't know what kind of picture to display along with the music. And they didn't want to put, for instance, something that looked like a bad, you'd find in a bad karaoke bar. And yet they couldn't always put the something up that had to do with the artist either for licensing problems there. So what we're on the cusp of there is this new music service by Google, and you would think that they would fold some of the Songsa attributes into that. And that's my assumption anyway, that it'll go that way and probably into Play All Access as well. So we can expect that in the future, and certainly it takes a while until that integrates into what they have now. One thing that is interesting, though, Mike, is what we're seeing here is a consolidation, a roll-up, so to speak, of the industry. And we're starting to see these smaller services picked off by the big three. The big three, of course, are Amazon, Google, and Apple. And I think what we're going to see eventually is those are going to be the three left standing, and there may be a fourth or a fifth. But all of the other 60-so numbers that, you know, are going right now, I think they're all going to be rolled up sooner or later in the next couple of years.
Yeah, absolutely. And you mentioned YouTube, the new YouTube that's coming. That, of course, is being spearheaded by Susan Wojcicki, who is a former longtime Google ad executive, and Susan Wojcicki's sister that Sergey Brin is married to, and so on. That's and in fact, it was their parents' house where Google was first headquartered. Jason Heiner, you've been following Google for many, many years, So to a certain extent, we want to kind of estimate what they might do with something like this. What they're almost certainly not going to do is just keep running it as its own service and just have a separate, you know, thing. They're probably going to do something super googly about it. We don't know what that is. My guess is that now that software like Google Now can listen to songs and identify songs, that some of this curation is going to be done by you yourself, for example, curating your own music. Google may, for example, listen to the music in your life and start to figure out what sort of music you like. But can you think of any other super googly things that Google might do with this particular service?
That they might do? Well, I think that, you know, the community bit is really interesting, right? And so that makes me immediately, because Songsa is kind of a community play with the curation aspect of what it does. And, you know, that makes me wonder if there's a Google Plus angle in here somewhere, right? Maybe letting you start your own curated channel or stations on Google Plus. A lot of these services do this. They let you set up your own playlist, set up your own kind of radio station, you know, as it were, and share that. And so there seems to be some natural possibilities for Google Plus on that. And we haven't heard much from Google Plus for a while. There have been reports that Google's maybe soured on it a little bit. Obviously, they had a change of leadership at Google Plus in recent months. And so, you know, this is it'll be an interesting test case to see, like, if they're pushing this more toward YouTube, if they push this more toward Google Play All Access, which is more sort of its Android ecosystem, or if they push this toward Google Plus, you know, and is some kind of reinvestment, give people a reason to do Google Plus and be at Google Plus besides Google Plus Hangouts, which is really kind of its only killer feature at the moment. So yeah, the bigger picture, though, I think, Mike, is that, you know, this does signal this buy and just sort of the Beats purchase combined together signals is this bigger trend in the industry of that pretty much streaming music services are winning. And the expectation, and obviously this is as good of a sign for Pandora and Spotify as it is for anybody else, because the Beats purchase and the songs are purchased by Google shows that, you know, they believe, or at least in some, they're at least hedging their bets that a big part of the future has to do with streaming music, both from, you know, Apple and Google standpoint.
Okay, so Bobby, I have a theory for you. I'm kind of interested in what Jason just said about the possibility of it being folded into Google Plus. That's super interesting in light of the acquisition by Beats Electronics by Apple, because the ultimate goal of Beats Music, that service, was to essentially have social curation around music and ultimately leverage the popularity of artists to sell things like headphones, for example, concert tickets, all kinds of other things. They call them 360 deals in Hollywood. And it's essentially where, instead of paying somebody for the music they record with a percentage of the sales, now that there's really no money in music, you sign somebody up to endorse all kinds of products and to sell things around music. And Google Plus would be a perfect place for that, because, of course, the number one and number two people on Google Plus are Lady Gaga and, you know, people like that. Lady Gaga is the poster child for 360 deals. And she's already got a huge, you know, following of probably approaching 10 million at this point, far more than she'll ever get on Beats Music. And so this could be a play for social curation on something like Google Plus. What do you think about that, Bobby? Would that be a good move for them in terms of competing with Apple and Beats Music?
Probably, but I don't think social and music so far hasn't proved to be a ideal combination. And there's some discussion as to whether that could ever work. Now, you would think it'd be a natural, but so far it really hasn't. And from what I gather, and this is from talking to people kind of in the know here, they found that it's an experiment that so far hasn't proved to be what anybody expected. For some reason, people don't much care about what you're listening, what their friends and family are listening to. They're more concerned, again, with a curator, someone they trust.
Yeah, that's a good point. That's a very good point. It must drive them crazy that the number one people on all the social networks are singers and people who create music. You know, in the top 100 of all the social networks, they're, you know, dominated by people who make music for a living, and they must think there must be some way to monetize that. Well, Bobby Osinski, I want to thank you for coming on Tech News today and explaining this story to us and bringing some new insight to it.
Thank you for having me, Mike.
You can find Bobby Osinski on bobbyosinski.com and also using his name, Bob Biosinski. Let me spell that. BobByoWSinski on Twitter. Thanks again. Well, in just a sec, we're going to tell you about what the FTC is saying to T-Mobile. Really interesting story there. But first, I want to tell you about Personal Capital. If you want to get your finances in order, you can't do that unless you know what's going on. And you can't know what's going on when your money and your financial situation is scattered all over the internet on different financial services. What Personal Capital can do, among many things, is bring it all together in one place and show you simple, easy-to-understand graphs so you can intuitively grasp what's happening with your money, with your investments, with your 401k, with your bank accounts, with your payments, everything all on one screen so you can see it. And of course, you can see those graphs, those charts and so on your computer, on your phone, your tablet, and you can see it in real time. And of course, all of the graphics are highly intuitive, and that's a big part of the point. They'll also show you how much you're overpaying in fees and help you to reduce those fees. So not only is it free, they'll actually save you money right off the bat by helping you to reduce unnecessary fees. So don't wait. Signing up just takes a minute, and it pays big dividends. Personal Capital gives you total clarity and transparency to make better investment decisions right away. To set up your free account, go to personalcapital.com/TNT. And remember that Personal Capital is free, and it's the smart way to grow your money. Just go to personalcapital.com/TNT. That's personalcapital.com/TNT. Well, the Federal Trade Commission is suing T-Mobile for a practice called cramming, where customers are billed for third-party services they don't use. The FTC says T-Mobile overcharged customers for hundreds of millions of dollars. T-Mobile basically told them to cram it. They said the lawsuit is without merit. John Prodkin is a senior IT reporter for Ars Technica and joins us now. Welcome, John.
Hey, thanks for having me.
So what is the FTC accusing T-Mobile of doing exactly? What is this cramming business?
There are all these third-party services, things like horoscopes or, I don't know, probably dating apps that people somehow get tricked into subscribing for. The company gets their phone number, and then all of a sudden you're paying $10 a month for some premium tech service that you've never heard of and that you never agreed to be charged for. And then when T-Mobile places the bill, the charge on your bill on behalf of these companies, and then T-Mobile takes about 30% of the 35 to 40% of the money. And a lot of people don't realize it because the charges are not explained well, or they're buried, you know, dozens of pages into a bill. And so even though they originated with third-party companies, the FTC is trying to hold T-Mobile responsible because they got tons and tons of complaints from consumers. They had to refund money to a lot of people, and yet this didn't set off any red flags. They didn't stop charging people for the services until regulators got involved and basically forced them to stop.
Now, T-Mobile says this is old news, that they've dealt with this long ago, and that therefore this whole thing is just false and bogus. Do you agree with that? Is this something they've already dealt with?
Well, it is in a way, but I think their reply, the T-Mobile CEO's reply, was really disingenuous. He said they're unfounded and without merit, but he didn't say that they didn't do this. He just said that they stopped doing it in November, and he made it sound like this amazing pro-consumer initiative, when in fact what happened was, in order to avoid a lawsuit, T-Mobile and the other carriers agreed to stop in an agreement that was signed with the attorneys general in 45 states. So they avoided a lawsuit by doing this. And then it's a little unclear why the FTC took this action yesterday. I read somewhere that the Federal Trade Commission, tried to come to a settlement with T-Mobile, and that, you know, those settlement talks didn't go anywhere. And so that's why the lawsuit was filed.
I've also read that the FCC, not the FTC, is investigating T-Mobile for the same practice. So one agency is investigating, the other is suing. Of course, T-Mobile is throwing those vaguely described third-party service providers, the horoscope people, under the bus, and basically saying it's all their fault and they're behaving irresponsibly. How common is this practice of cramming? Is T-Mobile alone in doing this, or do they all do it? How widespread is this?
I think it was fairly widespread because all four major carriers agreed to stop doing it last year. But according to the FTC lawsuit, it sounds like T-Mobile lagged behind a bit. There were certain very shady organizations that were charging these fees that the other carriers stopped allowing on their networks like more than a year before T-Mobile did.
I wonder if the T-Mobile CEO's horoscope warned him of all of these troubles. They certainly don't need this kind of problem right now. They're trying to sort of paint themselves as the uncarrier, the different kind of carrier that's very user-friendly and customer-friendly. So this is, if nothing else, going to be very bad for their reputation, which they're trying so hard to build up. John Brodkin is at arstechnica.com and on Twitter at jbrodkin. John Brodkin, I want to thank you for coming on Tech News today.
Thanks for having me.
All right. Microsoft is making a version of Microsoft Office for Android tablets. The suite would be on par with the company's recently released version of Office for the Apple iPad. Microsoft already offers Office for Android phones, but this would be their first offering for tablets. Jason Heiner, this is this inevitable, or is this a sign of a new Microsoft that's more aggressive at going after platforms that are not Windows?
Yeah, I think it is. I think it's them, you know, wanting to be more platform agnostic and just be a great software provider in addition to sort of a platform provider. It's just one of those things, like, how is it, how late's too late? You know what I mean? They and it's good that they're doing it. It's just one of those things, like, if they would have been on this, you know, with Office on these other platforms, they could have, they've left a lot of money on the table with iPhone and Android, iOS and Android, in terms of the number of, I think, the number of licenses they could have sold on those platforms if they came out with a reasonable version of the software. But that said, you know, it's good they're doing it. There's a lot of people that are still committed to it, although I think they lost, there's a lot of people they also lost to Google Docs and other people when people, when you couldn't, you know, do Office Docs very well on these devices. There were some third-party apps that would help you doing them. But I know a lot of people, anecdotally, that have, you know, basically said, you know what, I've pretty much moved to Google Docs at this point, and so, you know, I'm not going back. Yeah. That's what they're fighting against.
Absolutely. And you mentioned that they left a lot of money on the table. It's going to stay on the table, too, because the way these things work is that people who are committed to Office on the desktop or on Windows and then embrace other platforms like the iPad or like Android tablets, they're forced to go find another solution. And oftentimes when they find another solution, they kind of standardize on it. They get used to it. They like it.
Yeah.
And they, you know, Microsoft may be losing an Office customer in continuing into the future for decades. It's a terrible idea. They should have been right on this. And in fact, this happened to me when I first got the iPad in 2010. All my editors wanted Office documents. I really wanted to write on the iPad. And I just, yeah. I really wanted that. And I hoped that they would come out with it. I waited a few months and I'm like, you know what? I'm just going to try other things. I tried this. I tried that. I ended up on Google Docs and now I'm a super happy Google Docs user. And I don't even want to think about Office anymore. They lost me as a customer.
Yeah. Very similar experience here. And some, there are a few features, just a few features that Google does better. You know, interestingly enough, Office does a lot of things better. It has drawbacks. It's slow. It's a little clunky, you know, that kind of thing. Still, even some of the mobile apps, it's a little more complicated, but Google Apps just does a couple things better, mostly around collaborating on documents that, you know, once you get into that and you're used to doing that and sort of team collaboration and stuff, it's a killer feature. And, yeah. And the, you know, they haven't, they're still trying to catch up to that.
That's right. And I like Google Docs a lot. So, yeah. So they did me a favor. The FTC told Amazon to make it harder for children to buy things on smartphones and tablets without their parents' permission. Amazon told the FTC, "We'll see you in court." The Wall Street Journal found Amazon's response in a letter from Amazon to the FTC. Jason Heiner, this is quite an interesting thing. Essentially, what the FTC was requiring of Amazon is to stick to the same rules that it applied to Apple recently in a recent a lawsuit. And Amazon said, no. We're not going to use the same rules. We're going to have our own rules. And in fact, what they said was that we already make it clear to parents what their kids are buying. We refund immediately. We have clear notification that kids are not supposed to, you know, supposed to get permission and all that kind of stuff. They do everything that they're supposed to do, and they want to bring it into court so they can fight it in the court of law. This is a kind of a curious turn of events, but it's classic Amazon. They always want their own set of rules.
Yeah. There's a part of me that kind of respects what Amazon's doing here. I think they're saying, you know, our stuff is good enough. We've put controls in place. We're confident that those controls, you know, protect parents. They protect people from unauthorized purchases. And they're pushing back. They're pushing back pretty hard. So and they're also pushing back on, you know, maybe too much regulation in the tech industry in general. Maybe that's part of what they're doing in addition to this specific instance. So so good for them on that sense. I don't know, though, you know, that perception is it probably is a little easier for kids to buy stuff. And I think that's what the point is in this, to buy stuff on Amazon than it is sort of with the controls you can put in place in Apple. And so, you know, Amazon's pinning this on the fact that, well, if they do make unauthorized purchases, we refund them. You know, there's an appeal process and they can do it. That said, you know, there's lots of people, it's sort of, you know, path of least resistance. There's a lot of people that just will never get around to refunding $1 or $2 or, you know, if it's under $10, for a lot of people, it's not worth the hassle. And Amazon, you know, laughs all the way to the bank on that. And so I'm interested to see how this plays out, because I do think that Amazon is pushing back. And, you know, I think there's some good bits about that in terms of how much the FTC should be pushing them on this. But in truth, I think it is easier on their devices for kids to buy stuff that they, you know, that they're not authorized to. And so, you know, it's a legitimate concern.
Yeah, I'm of two minds. On the one hand, I agree with you. Less regulation is better regulation. And there's probably lots of regulation, possibly too much, on the tech industry in particular. A couple of things concern me about Amazon. One of them is that they really, really are going after children. And this is, of course, framed as a family-friendly thing, that it's a good thing. They have all-you-can-eat content
Definitely.
Services for children. They're actually creating yeah. original content for the Amazon Fire TV for children. They really want children. And to me, that's kind of the Ronald McDonald's approach to marketing. You get kids locked in as kids. When they grow up, they're still loyal and happy customers of the company. I guess there's nothing really wrong with that. What bugs me here in this conversation, what's missing in this conversation that you and I are having, is exactly what is the scale of this mm-hmm. of this problem. And Amazon is a very secretive company. They won't tell you, not only will they not tell you what the scale is, they won't tell us how many tablets they've shipped. They won't tell us how many Fire phones they're going to ship. They don't talk about anything they don't have to. And of course, that's their right. They're within the law. They're not breaking the law there. But the combination of extreme secrecy and aggressive marketing at children kind of gives me pause in all this, and their reluctance to stop something. If they're in fact stopping this problem, prove it. That's, I guess, what I'm saying. If you can show that the number of unauthorized purchases is very, very low, fantastic. Problem solved. I agree with
Tell
you,
us.
Amazon. But if you don't demonstrate that, I'm going to have to give it to the FTC here. If there's a problem, they need to deal with it, or they need to follow the same rules as everybody else. Now, a little funny anecdote. My wife recently visited a relative, and I won't mention any names, but she visited a relative of ours. And the daughter in this family had been ordering things from China, and packages were just showing up at the door. Just going shopping, you know, I somehow got the parents' credit card number, and this, you know, it made me think, you know, how big of a problem is this? How many, you know, you download software, it shows up in the bill, people pay things without reading them carefully. I wonder yeah. how much purchasing is going on by kids without the parents ever finding out.
Ooh, it's a great question.
Yeah.
It's a great question, especially with these in-app purchases and stuff.
Yeah.
It's really super easy.
Yeah.
It's a tough thing to manage as a parent, you know,
yeah.
So I've got two kids, and they're both, you know, they both buy stuff online. They both, you know, buy in-app purchases at different times. I've turned in-app purchases off when they were, you know, until they sort of were more trustworthy with it. But yeah, it's a big deal. And, you know, the thing that Amazon, it will be interesting to see if Amazon can survive and keep moving forward with being with as much lack of transparency as it's shown, as you brought up. And I think ultimately when companies like Google and Microsoft and, you know, even at times some of the things that Apple has done, you know, in terms of transparency, that puts more pressure on Amazon. It's hard to think of anybody being less transparent than Apple, you know, just famously and infamously secretive. But Amazon, you're right, is in the same boat. And, you know, for this kind of thing, transparency is important, and they need to step up, and they yeah. need to be better about being transparent about some of these things. It has nothing to do with their bottom line.
That's true.
It really does, ultimately. So
yeah, good point. Well, speaking of kids who are out of control, a new crowdfunded product called Kudoso doesn't let kids watch TV or use computers, tablets, or phones until they've earned it. By doing chores, homework, and piano practice, whatever the parents decide. It works at the router level. You can buy software that runs on your existing router, or you can buy a router with Kudoso installed. this is a trend, a larger trend, Jason Heiner, of using technology to limit kids. We've talked about this, a couple of other products on the show that do similar things that essentially put parents in control of media use. And of course, it's a widespread product problem in our society these days that kids are spending way too much time indoors looking at screens. It's not healthy. It's not good for their minds. It's not good for their bodies. And so, you know, maybe something like this can help. Now, this was founded by Rob Izzari, who's formerly of Right Now Technologies. He's the real deal. This is a four-person team at present, and they're integrated with Khan Academy. So they can actually allow kids to earn points, which can then be redeemed, essentially, to watch TV or something like that, by completing lessons at Khan Academy. How cool is that?
Yeah, you know, it's funny. I think this is a brilliant idea in terms of gamification of
parenting.
Screen time, gamification of parenting, gamification of, you know, chores. And I mean, it's one of those things that seems a little bit, you know, gamification has had kind of a mixed history. But when it comes to parents have been doing this kind of thing for years, for decades, for, you know, centuries, in terms of like, get these things done and then you earn the right to do X. And so, you know, turn it into something, an official sort of digital age, you know, product. Is kind of brilliant because it's one of those sort of ideas that, like I said, it's existed in sort of the human form for a long, long time. So would I necessarily, I don't know that I necessarily would do it, but I think I know a lot of people that would. And I think that it is kind of a fun idea.
Absolutely.
And I like the integration with Khan Academy too.
Yeah. Especially since there's so much content and television on phones and tablets and it's, how do you stop that? If kids have unfettered access to phones and tablets, how do you sort of control how much time they spend? You know, you say they go to bed, they turn off the light. Who knows if they're just watching TV until 3 o'clock in the morning? That's not good for their homework, and it's not good for their eyes. It's a bad thing. And you know, phones and tablets are an avenue toward doing stuff that the parents don't know what they're doing. So yeah, it's an interesting trend, and I think at some point somebody's going to get it right, and there'll be a lot more control over the over kids' use of media and so on. Well, just a sec, we're going to talk about a new robot that could be coming to a farm near you. But first, I want to tell you about ZipRecruiter. You want to hire great people. It's the most important decision you'll make as a hiring manager or as a small business owner. You got to hire great people. And if you hire people who are not so great, then your business is not going to succeed. The way to hire the best people is ZipRecruiter. And you can try it for free at ZipRecruiter.com/TNT. And so why is ZipRecruiter so great? Well, one reason is you can post to 50-plus job boards with one click. That's right. The best candidates are spread out all over the internet on all these different job boards. There's so many job boards, dozens and dozens of them. And people also can be found on social media, and ZipRecruiter helps you there as well. It'll post your job on social networks like LinkedIn, Facebook, Twitter, and Google+. And you'll look very professional doing it because you can add your company logo and colors to make your job pages an extension of your business and of your brand. So that's a very powerful thing to do. Now, what happens when you go across 50-plus job boards and all these social networks? You get flooded with applicants, many of which most of whom are probably not qualified for the job, and that just gives you a new problem. And ZipRecruiter will help you with that as well. They will find the best qualified candidates and present you those. They'll prioritize them so that the best qualified candidates rise to the top and you can go after them instead of wasting your time on people who are clearly not qualified. You screen them, you rate them, and then you hire the right person fast. Try ZipRecruiter and find out why they've been used by more than 100,000 businesses. Right now, our listeners can try ZipRecruiter for a free 4-day trial by going to ZipRecruiter.com/TNT. That's ZipRecruiter.com/TNT. And we thank ZipRecruiter for their support of Tech News Today. The latest job to be replaced by robots? Farm workers. Well, not yet, but it could happen in the near future. A new robot created at the University of Sydney in Australia and called the Ladybird does a variety of farm jobs. It's solar-powered, self-driving, laser-guided, and the robot can roll through the fields of a vegetable farm and use its sensors and special cameras to collect data on crop conditions and then zap all that information back to the farmer who's back at home enjoying a cold beverage in an air-conditioned room. Best of all, the Ladybird has a robot arm for pulling weeds. Boy, this is the future of farming right here. I think this is really great. This is probably the second or third serious effort at creating a farm robot that pulls weeds that I've seen, Jason Heiner, and I'm all for it because imagine if robots that can pull weeds becomes commonplace, you no longer need herbicides, and you no longer need GMO crops that can tolerate heavy doses of herbicides, and that is good. That makes better food.
That's a great thing. I love the story. We've been doing on Tech Republic. We've been doing a series of articles recently on the technology of food, and we did a big in-depth article in this spring on big data and food, and how big data is going to help feed 9 billion people by 2050. It's a big number that the food industry and farming industry talk a lot about, and it's one of those things we don't think of. Farming is a high-tech job, but it is rapidly becoming a very, very high-tech job. And so this fits right in with this. Like you said, it has an important effect on food. It also affects, jobs in interesting ways. It does replace, some jobs, certainly some manual labor jobs. Technology is also creating a lot of jobs in the farming industry because there's all kinds of problems and issues that can be attacked with technology. And so there are, a lot of people working on this problem, a lot more people, suddenly working on this problem and interested in this problem from sort of, IT companies to startups to, these researchers in Australia working on, this robot. So I think it's a pretty exciting time for food industry, farming industry, they're going through a lot of change and a lot of transformation, but ultimately it is better for us. It's better for the stuff we eat. It will ultimately be better. I think confident looking at the trends now for the things that we eat and sort of overall global health.
Yeah, absolutely. And the process of replacing farm work is not a new one. There was a time not too long ago, maybe 100 years ago, 150, 200 years ago, where the vast majority of Americans were engaged in farming. And now it's well under 4%. And I think that life is better and easier for the vast majority. And we produce a lot more food. Not only is the U.S., of course, self-sufficient, but exports food to all over the world. So technology applied to farming is generally a good thing, and robotics applied to farming is both inevitable and probably a really good thing, just like you said. Well, that is the tech news today. Jason Heiner, what are you up to these days? Where can people find your work?
Yeah, so you can find me on techrepublic.com. You can also find me on ZDNet.com. On Tech Republic, I'm the editor-in-chief. On ZDNet, I'm the global long-form editor. Actually, I'm the global long-form editor across ZDNet and Tech Republic. On ZDNet, we do these great packages every month of features. The one for July, which we just published yesterday, was on hybrid cloud, which is this idea of, keeping some things in the cloud and then some things, in your own sort of internal cloud and sort of connecting the two, which some companies are doing as a way to, transition to the cloud. On Tech Republic, we do a lot of what we kind of call cover stories, which are sort of long, in-depth features like the farming and big data one I mentioned. We've also did one this week or last week on PayPal, the PayPal mafia and how they transform Silicon Valley.
That was a great article.
A decade ago. Yeah. So, that's the stuff that I'm passionate about, that really working on doing sort of in-depth writing and reporting and, taking some of the most important stories deeper and just serving the audience and trying to write great stuff.
Fantastic. Well, it is great stuff, and I appreciate you coming on Tech News Today as our guest.
Always a pleasure. Thanks for having me, Mike.
All right. Well, you can subscribe to Tech News Today on iTunes, YouTube, Feedly, Yahoo, RSS, you name it. There are a million options. You can choose your favorite at twit.tv/TNT. And please follow us on Twitter. That's Tech News Today TV on Twitter. And we want to hear from you. Send us email at tnt@twit.tv or leave us voicemail by calling 260-TNT-SHOW. Also, don't miss our evening newscast, Tech News Tonight, at 4 p.m. Pacific tonight and every weeknight right here on the Twit Network. My name is Mike Elgin. Thanks for tuning in. We'll see you tomorrow.